Savitri, Book 8, The Book of Death, Canto 3, Death in the Forest. This is on pages 561 through 566. Sri Aurobindo began to write Savitri in 1916. The date of his first manuscript is August 8th, 9th, 1916. At that beginning time, he wrote Book 8, The Book of Death. Although Sri Aurobindo revised and changed most of Savitri, he did not do much work on the Book of Death. In the first fair copy of his earliest version of Savitri, the Book of Death is 133 lines long. In the final version that we have today, it is 177 lines long. Of the original 133 lines, 108 lines were never changed. This means that he later changed only 25 lines and added only 44 lines. In 1950, close to the time he left his body, Sri Aurobindo put the Book 8 aside, saying that he was going to work on it later, but he didn't get around to doing this work. So we have the Book of Death as far as he worked on it. There's only one canto in Book 8. It's called Canto 3 because it was called Canto 3 when it was the third canto in a much earlier version of Savitri. This original canto number was never changed by Sri Aurobindo. Therefore, no one else has changed it. Sri Aurobindo starts Book 8, Canto 3, by taking us back to the beginning of Savitri in Book 1, Canto 1. Here in Book 8, the first sentence he writes is, "Now it was here, in this great golden dawn." The dawn he speaks about is the symbol dawn, which is the title of Book 1, the Book of Beginnings, Canto 1, the symbol dawn. The it, that is here, is the day of Satyavan's death. In Book 1, Canto 1, Savitri slowly wakes up. At first, she does not remember what day it is, but then, as she wakens more and more, it all comes back to her. At the end of Book 1, Canto 1, Sri Aurobindo writes, "Then a slow, faint remembrance, shadow-like, moved, and sighing, she laid her hand upon her bosom and recognized the close and lingering ache, deep, quiet, old, made natural to its place, but knew not why it was there, nor whence it came. But now she stirred, her life shared the cosmic load. At the summons of her body's voiceless call, her strong, far-winging spirit traveled back across the ebbing seas of sleep. Her house of nature felt an unseen sway, illumined swiftly were life's darkened rooms, and memory's casements opened on the hours, and the tired feet of thought approached her doors. Amid the trivial sounds, the unchanging scene, her soul arose, confronting time and fate. Immobile in herself, she gathered force. This was the day that Satyavan must die. From there, all the way up to Book 8, that is 551 pages, all of Savitri is the history leading up to this moment. Up to now, it has all been a long flashback from the past. We have seen how Savitri's father, King Ashwapati, did his own yoga and then did the yoga for the world. He became the traveler of the worlds, traveling through all the planes and parts and worlds of his being, while at the same time traveling through all the corresponding universal planes. We have seen how he searched for the Divine Mother. He wanted to ask her to come to Earth and help mankind to progress faster. Then we saw how he found her and how she promised to take birth. She said, "Oh, strong forerunner, I have heard thy cry. One shall descend and break the iron law, change nature's doom by the lone spirit's power. She shall bear wisdom in her voiceless bosom. Strength shall be with her like a conqueror's sword. And from her eyes the eternal's bliss shall gaze. A seed shall be sown in death's tremendous hour, a branch of heaven transplant to human soil. Nature shall overleap her mortal step. Fate shall be changed by an unchanging will. Then came the story of Savitri's birth and her growth, and the story of her search for her mate. We saw how she found her eternal soulmate, Satyavan, in the deep forest. We saw how they knew that they belonged together. Sri Aurobindo wrote, "These knew each other, though in forms thus strange. Although to sight unknown, though life and mind had altered to hold a new significance, these bodies summed the drift of numberless births, and the spirit to the spirit was the same." As they speak to each other for the first time in this life, Savitri says to Satyavan, "All the deathless being in me knows that thou art he my spirit has sought amid earth's thronging visages and forms across the golden spaces of my life." And Satyavan tells Savitri, "Now I know that all I lived and was moved towards this moment of my heart's rebirth. I look back on the meaning of myself, a soul made ready on earth's soil for thee." When she found Satyavan, Savitri found the divine work for which she was born. She met the one person who is all to her. He is the partner of all she is and all she does, and she will do anything for him. In a year, she will have to save him from being carried off by death. This is the story of the Divine Mother who takes on a human body and has to bear the burden of the flesh. She also has to go through all of our human sufferings for our sake, because once she has conquered something in that body, it is universally available for everyone's body. Sri Aurobindo speaks of this from the beginning of the book. In Book 1, Canto 1, he writes, "To live with grief, to confront death on her road, the mortal's lot became the immortal's share. Thus trapped in the gin of earthly destinies, awaiting her ordeal's hour, abode, outcast from her inborn felicity, accepting life's obscure terrestrial robe, hiding herself even from those she loved, the Godhead, greater by a human fate." Then in Book 1, Canto 2, he writes about the conscious power that creates Savitri's fate. "One dealt with her who meets the burdened great, a signer of the ordeal and the path, who chooses in this holocaust of the soul, death, fall, and sorrow as the spirit's goads, the dubious Godhead, with his torch of pain, lit up the chasm of the unfinished world and called her to fill with herself the abyss. August and pitiless in his calm outlook, heightening the eternal's dreadful strategy, he measured the difficulty with the might and dug more deep the gulf that all must cross. Assailing her divinest elements, he made her heart kin to the striving human heart, and forced her strength to its appointed road. For this she had accepted mortal breath, to wrestle with the shadow she had come, and must confront the riddle of man's birth and life's brief struggle in matter's night." At the very end of Book 1, Sri Aurobindo says, "The great world mother now in her arose. A living choice reversed fate's cold dead turn, affirmed the spirit's tread on circumstance, pressed back the senseless dire revolving wheel, and stopped the mute march of necessity. A flaming warrior from the eternal's peaks, empowered to force the door denied and closed, smote from death's visage its dumb absolute and burst the bonds of consciousness and time. This is the moment which begins the book of death. Sri Aurobindo writes, "Now it was here, in this great golden dawn. By her still sleeping husband Lane, she gazed into her past, as one about to die looks back upon the sunlit fields of life, where he too ran and sported with the rest, lifting his head above the dark stream into whose depths he must forever plunge. All she had been and done, she lived again, the whole year, in a swift and eddying race of memories swept through her and fled away into the irrecoverable past." We have seen Savitri's yoga. We have been with her when she realized her soul and when she experienced nirvana and then attained cosmic consciousness. At that time, Sri Aurobindo wrote about how great and powerful she had become. He wrote, "She was a single being, yet all things. The world was her spirit's wide circumference. The thoughts of others were her intimates, their feelings close to her universal heart, their bodies, her many bodies, close to her. She was no more herself, but all the world. Out of the infinitudes all came to her, and to the infinitudes sentient she spread. Infinity was her own natural home. Nowhere she dwelt, her spirit was everywhere. She was time, and the dreams of God in time. She was space, and the wideness of his days. From this she rose where time and space were not. The superconscient was her native air. Infinity was her movement's natural space. Eternity looked out from her on time. Savitri is ready to conquer almighty death and to take her beloved soulmate back from death's all-conquering grasp." One of the things that Mother came here to do was to conquer death. Mother had a completely different view of death than most people have, because she was always conscious of her true existence as the Divine Mother in a human body. In her agenda, Mother spoke about her long interest in death and her work with the death process. She started when she was around 20 years old. At that time, she had no training in occultism and had never studied occultism. But she had certain conscious experiences at night, certain activities in which she was looking after people who were leaving their bodies. She did all this without having a conscious knowledge of the process. She said she did not know what she was doing, and she did not try to know, but she knew exactly what had to be done, and she did it. When Mother was 26, somebody introduced her to the teachings of an occultist named Max Theon. Then she read and understood all kinds of things she hadn't known before. She said that once she had this kind of conscious knowledge, she began to work quite systematically in a region between the purely terrestrial atmosphere of the earth and the psychic atmosphere of the higher worlds belonging to the soul. Around 1903 or 1904, she worked for many months in the lowest part of the universal vital plane, which is the closest to the earth plane. She worked to construct a bridge, a path of protection, so that people who died would be able to leave their body at death without having to go through this region. This is the first place people always passed through after death. She said that for people who are conscious, but without occult knowledge of these regions, it is a very difficult passage. In 1904, Mother went to Tlemcen, Algeria, to meet Max Theon and his wife, Alma. Alma was an extremely experienced occultist, even more so than her husband. Among the many things that Alma told Mother was that Mother's work to create this safe passage after death was part of the work that Mother came on Earth to do. She said that everyone with even a slightly developed soul, a slightly awakened psychic being, will be able to see Mother's light. When they die, they will go to Mother's Light at the moment of dying, and Mother will help them to pass through the death process. Mother said that the particular work of people coming to her when they left their body was a constant work for her. She mentions it several times in the agenda, speaking about people who died in the ashram and people who died outside of the ashram. Usually she tells what she did with them. She also said that this work gave her a considerable number of experiences concerning what happens to people when they leave their bodies and when they are reborn and take new bodies. She said that part of her work here was to conquer death. She said, "We have to die unto death." She called it the death of death. She also talked about death in the context of the work to transform her physical cells. She worked to get her cells to have the consciousness that no longer needs to degenerate and disintegrate back into the earth elements in the death process. When Savitri wakes up on this fateful morning, and she remembers that this is the day that Satyavan must die, she doesn't want his parents to know. She doesn't want them to see him die. So she asks permission from Satyavan's mother, the exiled queen, to go into the forest with her son. Very quietly and carefully, so as not to give any hint of danger or to alarm Satyavan's mother, Savitri says, "One year that I have lived with Satyavan here on the emerald edge of the vast woods, I have not gone into the silences of this great woodland, but this small clearing was my world. Now has a strong desire seized all my heart to go with Satyavan, holding his hand, into the life that he has loved. Release me now, and let my heart have rest." She answered, "Do as thy wise mind desires, O calm child sovereign with the eyes that rule." Then the doomed husband and the woman who knew went with linked hands into that solemn world where beauty and grandeur and unspoken dream, where nature's mystic silence could be felt communing with the secrecy of God. Satyavan does not know what will happen to him, and he is very happy that Savitri is with him. He was showing her all the things he had loved since his childhood, but Savitri could not stop thinking about the fact that very soon he was going to die. Sri Aurobindo said that the very nature of our soul is something that is put forth from the divine to support the evolution. It must continue to take birth until the divine's purpose in evolution is accomplished. One of our lives is only a brief episode in a long history of spiritual evolution in which the soul follows the curve of the line set for the earth. It passes through many lives to complete it. Its way, in our body, is to evolve out of material inconscious, the dense unconsciousness of physical matter which makes up our bodies, and to become more and more conscious on the way to the full consciousness of the self which is the all, which is called in India the Atman. Sri Aurobindo said, "Death is necessary as a process of life, because eternal change of form is the only kind of immortality that our finite living substance can aspire to have. Eternal change of experience is the only infinity which our finite mind, living in our finite body, can attain. The change of our form when we take a new body is necessary because nothing ever stays the same. The very nature of time and space demand variety of experience. But now that the new force is coming into the earth plane, the way that all this has happened in the past up to now is going to change. Eventually, man will evolve beyond the limited mind, and man will be able to have the supramental Satchitananda consciousness. The body will be transformed so that it won't have to go through the old death process." Mother and Sri Aurobindo use the term supramental transformation in the context of speeding up the pace of universal evolution to a very great degree. Then there would be a complete change in our physical body in a relatively short time as the new supramental forces continue to manifest here. Then the process of having to change to a new body will also change. They also said that universal evolution is an endlessly ongoing transformation at the slow pace of universal nature. We never stop being transformed. Leaving the body by dying and then getting a new body by being reborn are part of our endless transformation. So you cannot call death a denial of life or an end of life. It is part of the ongoing experience of life. If we are not transformed completely, we wear out our bodies and have to come back and take new ones to play out our part in the curve of progress set for the Earth. When people hear the word transformation, they tend to concentrate on the descriptions of the supramental transformation. This is the end result of the accelerated transformation that can now take place with the new forces coming. But it helps to remember that we are always being transformed by universal evolution. Mother and Sri Aurobindo emphasize that we do not cease to be because our physical body ceases to be. Mother explains that there is really no such thing as the end of a person, the end which we call death. There is only an appearance of disappearance based on a limited outlook, but there is no radical change in the vibration of consciousness. Consciousness is immortal in its very nature. Sri Aurobindo said that his experience led him to believe that even if people choose to merge completely with the Supreme Consciousness, there is always some sort of vibration of them as a separate entity somewhere as long as there is a manifestation of the Supreme. He once wrote to someone, "There is nothing to grieve about, as death means passing over to another country to which you probably go very often when you are asleep. Death is only the shedding of the body, not a cessation of personal existence. A man is not dead because he goes to another country and changes his clothes to suit that climate." Sri Aurobindo said that in death, you go out of this physical frame in another kind of body, not physical. You are the same person with the same consciousness. He describes this in Savitri. We are going to see it in Satchavan's death when we come to Book 9. When Satyavan nears the end of his chores in the forest, he has one final thing to do before he can finish his day's work. Then he and Savitri can wander free in the green, deep, primeval mystery of the forest's heart. He chooses a tree and begins to cut off one of its branches. But as he cuts the tree with his axe, his doom comes upon him. Sri Aurobindo writes as though Satchavan were another tree in the great forest of life. He says, "Now the great woodsman hewed at him, and his labor ceased. Lifting his arm, he flung away the poignant axe far from him like an instrument of pain. She came to him in silent anguish and clasped. And he cried to her, 'Savitri, a pang cleaves through my head and breast as if the axe were piercing it and not the living branch. Such agony rends me as the tree must feel when it is sundered and must lose its life. A while, let me lay my head upon thy lap and guard me with thy hands from evil fate. Perhaps because thou touchest, death may pass.'" And so Savitri sits under another tree, holding her beloved, guarding him in her bosom as he is dying. At the very end, he cries to her, "Savitri, Savitri, O Savitri, lean down, my soul, and kiss me while I die." And as they kiss, his spirit leaves his body. When Satyavan is gone, when he loses all of his life, Savitri becomes aware that they are not alone any longer. Sri Aurobindo writes, "Something had come there, conscious, vast, and dire. Near her she felt a silent shade immense, chilling the noon with darkness for its back." Mother spoke about this phenomenon in some detail. There are stories about death coming for people in the myths and legends of all cultures. Each culture describes the physical appearance of the being called death in a different way. Mother has some experience of this, and she speaks about it. In her different teachings about why human beings have to die, Mother explains different reasons for death. She said that one of the reasons we die is because a subtle being, which she calls the spirit of death, comes to take us. We will see that she even has a solution for this experience, which at first glance seems inescapable. Mother spoke in detail on the subject. She said, "There is an extraordinary organization, and one cannot even know to what extent it is organized. I believe there are many of these spirits of death. I believe there are hundreds. I have met at least two of them. One I met in France, and the other in Japan. They were very different, which leads me to believe that probably in accordance with the mental culture, the education, the country, and the beliefs, there should be different spirits. But there are spirits of all the manifestations of nature. There are spirits of fire, spirits of air, of water, of rain, of wind, and there are spirits of death. Each spirit of death, whatever it may be, has a claim to a certain number of deaths per day. Indeed, it is a kind of alliance between the vital forces and the forces of nature. For example, if the spirit of death has decided, that is the number of people to which I am entitled, say 4 or 5 or 6, or 1 or 2 persons, it depends on the day, it has decided that certain persons would die. It goes straight to the person and settles down beside the person about to die. But if you happen to be conscious, not the person death has chosen, but you, if you can see the spirit going to a certain person and you do not want him to die, if you possess a certain occult power, you tell it, 'No, I forbid you to take him.' It was a thing that has happened several times when I was in Japan, and also here. It was not the same spirit. That is what makes me say there must be many." Then Mother imitates the conversation with the spirit of death. You say, "I don't want him to die." And death says, "But I have the right to one death." Then you say, "Go and find someone who is ready to die." Then Mother goes on, "So I have seen several cases. Sometimes it's just a neighbor who dies suddenly in the place of the other. Sometimes it is just an acquaintance, and sometimes it is an enemy. Naturally, there is a relation, good or bad, of neighborhood or of anything else. But there is a relation which looks like chance." Here is Mother's advice for someone who was dying on how to make the spirit of death go away. When someone is dying and knows they are about to die, two things are necessary. It depends upon the people. First of all, nothing in your being, no part of your being, should want to die. This does not happen often. You always have a defeatist in you, something that is disgusted, something that has had enough of it, something that is lazy, something that says, "Ah, well, let it be finished, so much the better." That is sufficient. You are dead. But it is a fact. If nothing, absolutely nothing in you consents to die, you will not die. For someone to die, there is always a second, perhaps 1/100th part of a second, where he gives his consent. If there is not this second of consent, he does not die. Usually one gives way, because one must struggle. One must be strong, One must be very courageous and enduring, must have great faith in the necessity of life. Someone who feels very strongly that he still has something to do, and he must absolutely do it. But it has to be someone who is sure he has not within him the least bit of a defeatist somewhere, who just yields and says, it is all right. We can see that the more conscious we are, and the stronger we are, the more control we have. We have to give our consent for the decentralization of our being at death. And we have to consent, or the spirit of death cannot take us. Sri Aurobindo does not give us much of a physical description of the particular spirit of death which comes to take Satyavan. Instead, in order to end the Book of Death, he describes what we think the coming of death does to our life and to the lives of those around us. This makes us form our own mental picture of death. He writes, "A terror and an anguish filled the world, as if annihilation's mystery had taken a sensible form. A cosmic mind looked out on all from formidable eyes, condemning all with its unbearable gaze, and with immortal lids and a vast brow, it saw in its immense destroying thought all things and all beings as a pitiful dream, rejecting with calm disdain nature's delight, the wordless meaning of its deep regard, voicing the unreality of things and the life that would be forever but never was, and its brief and vain recurrence without cease, as if from a silence without form or name, the shadow of a remote uncaring God doomed to his naught the illusory universe, cancelling its show of idea and act in time and its imitation of eternity. She knew that visible death was standing there, and Satyavan had passed from her embrace. The Book of Death, Death in the Forest. Now it was here, in this great golden dawn. By her still sleeping husband Lane, she gazed into her past as one about to die looks back upon the sunlit fields of life, where he too ran and sported with the rest, lifting his head above the huge dark stream into whose depths he must forever plunge. All she had been and done, she lived again. The whole year, in a swift and eddying race of memories, swept through her and fled away into the irrecoverable past. Then silently she rose, and, service done, bowed down to the great goddess simply carved by Satyavan upon a forest stone. What prayer she breathed, her soul and Durga knew. Perhaps she felt in the dim forest huge the infinite mother watching over her child. Perhaps the shrouded voice spoke some still word. At last she came to the pale mother queen. She spoke, but with guarded lips and tranquil face, lest some stray word or some betraying look should let pass into the mother's unknowing breast, slaying all happiness and the need to live, a dire foreknowledge of the grief to come. Only the needed utterance passage found. All else she pressed back into her anguished heart and forced upon her speech an outward peace. 1 year that I have lived with Satyavan here on the emerald edge of the vast woods, in the iron ring of the enormous peaks, under the blue rifts of the forest sky, I have not gone into the silences of this great woodland that enringed my thoughts with mystery, nor in its green miracles wandered. But this small clearing was my world. Now has a strong desire seized all my heart to go with Satyavan, holding his hand, into the life that he has loved, and touch herbs he has trod, and know the forest flowers, and hear at ease the birds and the scurrying life that starts and ceases, rich far rustle of boughs, and all the mystic whispering of the woods. Release me now, and let my heart have rest. She answered, Do as thy wise mind desires, O calm child sovereign with the eyes that rule. I hold thee for a strong goddess who has come pitying our barren days. So dost thou serve even as a slave might. Yet art thou beyond all that thou doest, all our minds conceive, like the strong sun that serves earth from above. Then the doomed husband and the woman who knew went with linked hands into that solemn world where beauty and grandeur and unspoken dream, where nature's mystic silence could be felt communing with the secrecy of God. Beside her, Satyavan walked full of joy because she moved with him through his green haunts. He showed her all the forest's riches, flowers innumerable of every odor and hue, and soft, thick, clinging creepers, red and green, and strange, riched plumage birds. To every cry that haunted sweetly distant boughs, replied with the shrill singer's name, more sweetly called. He spoke of all the things he loved. They were his boyhood's comrades and his playfellows, coevals and companions of his life here in this world, whose every mood he knew. Their thoughts, which to the common mind are blank, he shared. To every wild emotion felt an answer. Deeply she listened, but to hear the voice that soon would cease from tender words and treasure its sweet cadences beloved for lonely memory when none by her walked, and the beloved voice could speak no more. But little dwelt her mind upon their sense. Of death, not life, she thought, or life's lone end. Love in her bosom hurt with jagged edges of anguish, moaned at every step with pain, crying now, now perhaps his voice will cease forever. Even by some vague touch oppressed, sometimes her eyes look round, as if their orbs might see the dim and dreadful god's approach. But Satyavan had paused. He meant to finish his labor here, that happy, linked, uncaring, they too might wander free in the green, deep, primeval mystery of the forest's heart. A tree that raised its tranquil head to heaven, luxuriating in verdure, summoning the breeze with amorous wideness of its boughs, he chose, and with his steel assailed the arm, brown, rough, and strong, hidden in its emerald dress. Wordless, but near, she watched, no turn to lose of the bright face and body which she loved. Her life was now in seconds, not in hours. And every moment she economized, like a pale merchant leaned above his store, the miser of his poor remaining gold. But Satyavan wielded a joyous axe. He sang high snatches of a sage's chant that pealed of conquered death and demons slain, and sometimes paused to cry to her sweet speech of love and mockery tenderer than love. She, like a pantheress, leaped upon his words and carried them into her cavern heart. But as he worked, his doom upon him came. The violent and hungry hounds of pain traveled through his body, biting as they passed silently, and all his suffering breath besieged, strove to rend life's strong heart cords and be free. Then helped, as if a beast had left its prey, a moment in a wave of rich relief, reborn to strength and happy ease, he stood rejoicing and resumed his confident toil, but with less seeing strokes. Now the great woodsman hewed at him, and his labor ceased. Lifting his arm, he flung away the poignant axe far from him like an instrument of pain. She came to him in silent anguish and clasped. And he cried to her, "Savitri, a pang cleaves through my head and breast, as if the axe were piercing it and not the living branch. Such agony rends me as the tree must feel when it is sundered and must lose its life. A while let me lay my head upon thy lap and guard me with thy hands from evil fate. Perhaps because thou touchest, death may pass." Then Savitri sat under branches wide, cool, green against the sun, not the hurt tree which his keen axe had cloven, that she shunned, but leaned beneath the fortunate kingly trunk. She guarded him in her bosom and strove to soothe his anguished brow and body with her hands. All grief and fear were dead within her now, and a great calm had fallen. The wish to lessen his suffering, the impulse that opposes pain, were the one mortal feeling left. It passed. Griefless and strong, she waited like the gods. But now his sweet familiar hue was changed into a tarnished grayness, and his eyes dimmed over, forsaken of the clear light she loved. Only the dull and physical mind was left, vacant of the bright spirit's luminous gaze. But once, before it faded wholly back, he cried out in a clinging last despair, "Savitri, Savitri, O Savitri, lean down, my soul, and kiss me while I die." And even as her pallid lips pressed his failed, losing last sweetness of response. His cheek pressed down her golden arm. She sought his mouth still with her living mouth, as if she could persuade his soul back with her kiss, then grew aware that they were no more alone. Something had come there, conscious, vast, and dire. Near her she felt a silent shade immense, chilling the noon with darkness for its back. An awful hush had fallen upon the place. There was no cry of birds, no voice of beasts. A terror and an anguish filled the world, as if annihilation's mystery had taken a sensible form. A cosmic mind looked out on all from formidable eyes, condemning all with its unbearable gaze. And with immortal lids and a vast brow, it saw in its immense destroying thought all things and beings as a pitiful dream, rejecting with calm disdain nature's delight. The wordless meaning of its deep regard, voicing the unreality of things, and life that would be forever, but never was, and its brief and vain recurrence without cease, as if from a silence without form or name, the shadow of a remote uncaring God doomed to his naught the illusory universe, cancelling its show of idea and act in time and its imitation of eternity. She knew that visible death was standing there, and Satyavan had passed from her embrace.